Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. Amid widespread confusion about the impact of the Affordable Care Act and uncertainty about its future, Hawaii's principal health care providers are asking for double-digit increases in their premiums, both citing the ACA or its potential repeal as the reason. The proposed double-digit increases for HMSA and for Kaiser would affect some 74,000 people currently covered by the ACA. Gordon Ito has served as Hawaii's insurance commissioner under the past three governors, and he's with us in our studio to help us figure it all out. Gordon, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, aloha. Glad to be here, Chris.
There's quite a bit to figure out, as I'm sure in your interactions with the public. Do you sense confusion, uncertainty?
Yeah, there's much confusion and uncertainty with respect to what's happening on the Affordable Care Act, also known as ACA or Obamacare plans, in the individual and small group market, and the continuing requested, double-digit increases from HMSA and Kaiser.
When I looked at some news reports about the request, I was left wondering if, the ACA was the reason, or its imminent, or the possibility of its repeal was the reason. Is it or ain't it? Kind of.
Well, part of it can be attributed to the law in ACA, but part of it can be attributed to what's happening in really the overall healthcare market, because the healthcare expenditures continue to increase at 6 to 9% every year, far outpacing wages and inflation. So that's, one of the underlying reasons.
What are the drivers of those increases on that end, the expenditures end?
So on the expenditures, there's an aging population in Hawaii. Generally, the older you get, you utilize more medical services. Mm-hmm. So that's some of the drivers, pharmaceutical costs with the new drugs that are coming, which are some of them are very expensive. There's many, many factors impacting rates.
What has the ACA made better for people in Hawaii?
Well, I think what's often lost in really the discussion on ACA, whether it's good or bad, is prior to ACA, if you had a pre-existing medical condition, medical insurers could deny you access to health care insurance. Mm-hmm. And so from that standpoint, it's a lot better, because anybody who wants to buy health care insurance can buy, health care insurance. What's causing part of the problem, in particular the ACA individual pool, is the pool size is very small. There's only the ones from CMS, the Center for Medicaid Medical Services report, indicated for this year about 16,711 purchased from healthcare.gov. Put that 16,000 or 17,000 lives in context of the overall market of about 800,000 covered lives in the commercial health market, it's a very small pool.
Yeah.
So that's creating volatility. And there's a tendency the morbidity or the health of the individuals in the pool is sicker. And they're incurring or utilizing much more medical service on a percentage basis than the general population. So that's causing the rate request increases to
why? What is it about that particular population? I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, again, with ACA, what's different from the ACA rate is one of the controversial things is ACA plans are based on what they call age rating. Uh-huh. So the younger you are, the cheaper the plan is. And again, it's based on general insurance principles. So the older you get, your rates go up. But if you have a medical condition or serious medical condition, your rates don't skyrocket, because you have a serious medical condition last year or you had like $500,000 medical bill.
The overall costs do skyrocket.
Yeah, the overall costs, but not on the individual basis. It's set really based on your age. Mm-hmm. That's how your rates are determined, the ACA plan.
So this particular population is older and perhaps sicker.
Yeah, so what's impacting the rate increases? By now, we were hoping that the ACA rate increase for individual and small group would start stabilizing. But the three factors that are really impacting the rates is, again, the pool size is small.
Right.
The morbidity is bad. The health of the people in the pool is bad. And also the uncertainty of what's happening with ACA. Mm-hmm. And two things in particular, One is that what we call the cost-sharing reduction, also known as CSRs, which are monies that are given by the federal government to help subsidize copay and deductibles for certain segment of the people in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to lose that CSR, about $10 million in revenue would be lost that the health plans would utilize. So that's causing about a 5 to 8% increase in the double-digit increase requests.
The cost-sharing, let me just interrupt you briefly, yeah. Gordon. The cost-sharing reduction is meant to reduce the burden on individuals?
Yeah, on individuals' out-of-pocket costs, you know, when they do get medical, what they call co-payments and
that's federal money.
Federal money. And so what the debate now is whether that's going to be continued to be funded or not.
Mm-hmm.
The other impact is really the individual mandate. I mean, a part of ACA's requirement for all individuals to help have health care insurance, there's non-enforcement of it at the present time. And so what's happening is tendency, the younger, healthier people are not buying insurance. So mm-hmm. those younger, healthier people in that pool are leaving, making the morbidity worse than what it is.
When, in fact, what the system needs to thrive is an increase in the number of younger, healthier people, and that would sort of balance things out overall. Is that accurate?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that's some of the things that are impacting the rate.
It does seem as if we're moving in the other direction, though, doesn't it?
Well, when you see on the ACA individuals, yes, definitely. And on the rates, you know, I keep saying these rates are not sustainable. And even on the general population rates in the large employer group plans and healthcare expenditures, 6 to 9%, it's not sustainable. We got to do something to address the healthcare cost drivers and bend that cost curve so you know, the increases are, say, 2 or 3%, not 6, 7, 9, 10, 15% every year.
What are the, when you say we got to do something, what are the somethings we can do?
So we are looking at it. So one thing on the ACA individual, we're looking at maybe potentially creating a high-risk reinsurance program to balance out the high-cost expenditures.
Insuring the insurance companies, in effect.
Yeah, basically they would get reinsurance to cover the high cost. The other thing we're looking at is we're at this very moment doing a data call to identify really what are the cost drivers. We did an initial data call, and it was very interesting because just over a three-year span for dialysis, I mean, the cost had gone from $7 million in 1 year to about $13 the next year to $24 million the following year and was projected to be over $26-27 million the following year, and that's just over a four-year span. So those are the things that we need to identify what's causing it and try to address, you know, the people who are ending up in, say, dialysis and really hopefully improve their health and avoid them from getting onto dialysis.
Well, part of that would come, I would hope, from advances in research, but part of it is just, you know, an industry policing itself at some point, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, there's abuses in certain areas that have to be addressed. But overall, I think Hawaii is a very unique state. We're very community-minded. I am very optimistic that we can identify really the cost drivers and developing programs to address it, to bend the cost curve. And I must say that, you know, the Department of Health and Human Services, they're doing a great job already in trying to address some of the issues.
Well, Gordon, I appreciate being able to introduce an optimistic note into this discussion, right? Always welcome. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
Gordon Ito has served as Hawaii's insurance commissioner under Governors David Ige, Neil Abercrombie, and Linda Lingle.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kelly O'Neill's in Waikiki and O'Toole's Irish Pub in downtown Honolulu. This month's live music schedule is available at irishpubhawaii.com.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ran Ozawa.
Next time on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll find out about a project that brings together traditional knowledge and storytelling with game design.
The project is called Skins, and it's part of the Initiative for Indigenous Futures Partnership to create new culturally based stories.
That's next time on Bite Marks Cafe, Wednesday at 6:30 p.m.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, another chapter in the ongoing debate over the uses of public land. But first, your quiz. We just had a discussion about the cost of health care insurance plans provided under the Affordable Care Act. So in today's backyard quiz, we're looking back in Hawaii's health care history. The Kalaupapa leprosy colony is one of the more prominent and controversial aspects of that history. It's not known exactly when Hansen's disease came to Hawaii, but cases began to appear in the islands around the mid-19th century. At the time, there was no cure for the highly stigmatized malady, which was most likely brought by a sugar plantation immigrant. Although the vast majority of humans are naturally immune to Hansen's disease, the gruesome deformities and lack of a cure led to the exiling of patients around the world to isolated colonies called leprosaria. In 1865, the kingdom's legislature passed a law creating the Kalaupapa Leper Settlement, as it was then called, during the reign of Kamehameha V. Our question for you today, what was the original Hawaiian name for the disease? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
The Kahala Hotel and Resort has withdrawn a request for an easement to use state public shoreline for commercial enterprises, including torch lighting ceremonies, weddings, and outrigger canoe rides for hotel guests. The questions raise yet again, who draws the line on uses of public land, and where should it be drawn? The Kahala's original plan was opposed by the Wailaikahala Neighborhood Board. Its chairman, Richard Turbin, has a meeting coming up with the hotel's managers to look at what should happen next. And he's with us in our studio. Hi, Richard. Thanks for coming in.
Aloha, Chris. It's great to be here.
What was the problem with this request from your perspective?
Okay. Well, the major problem is it violated a very important principle that's enshrined in the Hawaii State Constitution, and it's enshrined in Hawaii State law.
Nobody owns the beach.
Nobody owns the beach but the public.
Right.
And the government holds the beaches in trust for the public.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem, now let's go back to the Kahala Hotel and Resort. For many years, since it opened, actually in the 1960s, it's had a permit to use the beach, a revocable permit, to use the beach for its hotel guests. Mm-hmm. Of course, its hotel guests had the right to use the beach anyway. They're considered the public.
Right.
But in any event, all in all, that arrangement worked very well. I think most of the residents of Kahala and elsewhere would consider that the Kahala Hotel and Resort, by and large, has been a good neighbor, has cooperated with the public. And it seemed to me and a lot of others that the status quo was a good arrangement. But
so if you went to that beach, you might be sharing space with some hotel guests.
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah. But then the you know, the give and take is that the hotel greatly improved the beach for the use of not only its hotel guests, but for the public. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, it dredged it out, so it was a good, safe swimming area. It put a float in the middle of the bay, mm-hmm. pretty nice, that everybody could use. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it also had a swimming pool nearby. You can jump in and get the salt water off, use its, cafe, enjoy watching the dolphins play and the turtles.
Pretty free public access.
Yeah, and pretty free public access.
Sides, right?
Yeah, pretty free public access. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I was not aware of them ever trying to throw anybody off the beach. I mean, they did have weddings. They had a wedding chapel. They have a wedding chapel, apparently, too, on its property. And once in a while, you know, there'd be a wedding, and you might want to wait, and wait till the vows were completed before mm-hmm. you went out and used the water. So I think all in all, the arrangement was pretty good. And apparently for some probably business reason, the Kahala Hotel and Resort made an application to buy an easement from the state. Easement for the beach.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with an easement for the beach, for use of the beach, is now the hotel owns a property right. An easement is a property right to use the beach for their commercial purposes, for the various commercial purposes, or for whatever purposes they want. Now, it's a non-exclusive easement in the sense that the public still has a right to use the beach. But with the hotel owning a property right to really arrange, rearrange, utilize the beach in any way it wants.
That's a step further.
It's a step far, far, far beyond.
Bridge too far.
Yes, the bridge too far. You said it very well. And it would definitely chill, disturb, prevent, be an obstacle for the public to use the beach. Now, I just want to add one thing. Anecdotally, I have heard that in the past, different hotels around the state on five different occasions have asked the Department of Land and Natural Resources for the right to buy easements. And five previous times, the DLNR said, no, we cannot do that. We will not allow that to happen.
So this would be without precedent. Why did they want to do it? I mean, we should add that it's now been withdrawn, but what was the motivation behind this, you know, essentially precedent-breaking permission that
well,
they sought?
Well, anybody would like to have an easement for a beach in the state of Hawaii. I mean, what a wonderful thing to have. How valuable would it be? I mean, certainly would increase the value of the Kahala Hotel and Resort if by chance they had plans, the owners of the hotel had plans to resell it to another business entity. Certainly the value would be a lot greater. Plus, they would be free to have all kinds of commercial activities. I'm thinking, I don't know if this was their plan. Apparently, they said it wasn't. But, of course, you know, in Waikiki, you have these very lucrative booze cruises on the beach in Waikiki. Very nice for tourists. But very valuable. I mean, it's a valuable income, provides a valuable income stream for the hotels that sells the booze cruises.
Richard, in making this application, I doubt the Kahala Resort said we want to make more money. What was their stated?
Well, their stated goal in their application was to spend $900,000 on improvements for the beach and for the leasehold property that they have the property rights to near the beach. I believe they stated they wanted to build one more wedding chapel. They wanted to start having canoe rides for its guests from the beach. So maybe they were planning to build a facility to store canoes. They also wanted to have a torch lighting ceremony. This is what their application said they wanted to do.
Well, given that it's been withdrawn, are we just beating a dead horse here? Or, you know, has this issue gone away?
Well, I'm going to find out. I just came from out of town yesterday, so I didn't read the letter until this morning. But yesterday, the general manager of the hotel, Gerald Glennon, sent me a very nice letter, extremely nice letter, informing me that they notified Suzanne Case, chair of the Board of Land and Natural Resources, that they are formally withdrawing their draft environmental assessment out of respect for and appreciation of the comments and concerns expressed by the community. And he asked if he could meet with me next Monday at 10 a.m., and I certainly said, sure, delighted.
Is this a happy ending
for
all?
Yeah, this seems like a very happy ending. Of course, it does it, and he wants to develop an ongoing dialogue with the neighborhood board, which is a great thing, and we certainly appreciate it. So I respond to Mr. Glennon with arms wide open.
Yeah.
Yes, let's do this, and let's have a good constructive relationship. This doesn't mean that he cannot apply to purchase an easement in the future. I mean, he might.
Well, let's keep an eye on it.
But let's hope for the best.
I agree.
Let's hope for the best. And this was, unbelievably good news.
Terrific.
Which I just got this morning, and how fortuitous that I had a chance here to talk with you.
We'll keep track of this, Richard, going forward and see what develops. Thanks very much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, and much aloha,
sure.
And thank you for your interest in this very important issue.
Sure. Richard Turbin is the chairman of the Wailea-Kahala Neighborhood Board.
Aloha, I'm Ai-Jun Poo, co-director of Caring Across Generations, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In the aftermath of a marathon public hearing that included some sharp questioning from state lawmakers, we still don't know how Honolulu's troubled rail project is going to be funded. Will tourists assume part of the burden via a hotel room tax, or will Oahu residents assume it via an increase in the general excise tax? Yesterday's event laid out the issues and set the stage for the upcoming special session, but time is growing short with a federal deadline coming up. Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton covered yesterday's hearing. He's on the line with today's reality check. Hi, Stuart. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
What did we learn yesterday that we didn't know before, if anything?
Well, one thing we learned was that the legislature really seemed unwilling to simply grant Mayor Caldwell's request for a 10-year GE tax extension.
Mm-hmm.
The mayor wanted that. It's a half percent tax just for Oahu, and it is the mayor and some city council members' preferred method of paying for the rail.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really buy that.
Well, the other proposal in play is the hotel room tax, right?
Well, that's one idea, and they didn't really discuss that. But what they did discuss was that the GE tax extension, one of the takeaways was that extending the GE tax for 10 years, as the mayor wants, would actually produce a surplus. So it would really produce more money than the rail needs to be completed. That was one of the takeaways and one of the things that they discussed that, again, goes against this 10-year tax extension. The other idea that came out was that imposing a new tax instead of extending the GE tax would save money in interest costs and financing fees. And this was something that both the WAM chair, Donovan de la Cruz, or the Ways and Means Committee chair, and the House Finance Committee chair, Sylvia Luke, both talked about. So that's two sides of the aisle, both focusing in on this desire to save financing fees by with some kind of new tax rather than the extension. And again, the House Speaker also mentioned that could save about $1 billion in financing fees.
So, well, because debt service is huge for this project, isn't it?
Right. So that was the idea, that it would, by extending the GE tax, it's just pushing it out further and would be using a lot of that money to pay debt service, whereas coming in with a new tax would, as they say, front load it, and it wouldn't be as much of a debt service fee.
Excise taxes aren't terribly popular with tax reform people, are they?
No. The problem with excise taxes is that they are regressive. That means that the lower-income people and middle-income people tend to sort of pay more proportionately more of a of their income in these sorts of taxes. So that was one of the other things that came out in an interview with one of the legislators yesterday after the meeting.
So there's still, all of this is still in play. We don't really have we're still in a climate of uncertainty, aren't we, Stuart?
That's right. The one thing that was interesting is, though, Ed Case, the former congressman, came up. He was representing Outrigger Hotels and Resorts. He came out speaking against the testifying against an increase in the hotel tax, and he was pretty sharply questioned by the legislators. Again, nobody proposed anything. We still have to wait and see what kind of bill could be proposed, but the questioning was pretty sharp, and I think reading between the lines, it was clear that the legislators were not completely opposed to increasing the hotel tax.
Well, they certainly kicked that idea around before. Stuart, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
You bet. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, and today that featured reporter Stuart Yurton. You don't often hear the arts spoken of as a driver for the economy, but they have an impact far beyond what you might expect. Some of the few drivers of the economy that are underreported. That's a mistake. It may be part of the reason the arts are hurting for support in an increasingly materialist society. Randy Cohen is Vice President of Research and Policy at Americans for the Art. He has some figures to back up his theme that great art is good business. He's with us in our studio. Hi, Randy.
Aloha, Chris. Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. You're on a mission.
I'm on a mission, and I've got a good news story to tell, which is a wonderful mission to be on, right?
Always welcome, in today's environment, right?
Absolutely. You know, we all love the arts, and Hawaii is such an arts-rich state. Mm-hmm. The music, the dance is so deeply embedded in the root and the heritage and the fabric of the community here and really all across the country. Well, Hawaii was one of 341 study regions, the most comprehensive economic impact study of the arts ever conducted. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that in addition to improving our quality of life and bringing us joy and inspiration, all the wonderful things that the arts do, they're also good for the economy. Mm-hmm. They support jobs. They return revenue to the government. It changes the story of our local arts organizations from charity, you know, needing investment and that type of thing, to one of industry.
Well, when we talk about supporting the arts, you get this image of starving artists with their hand out, right?
Yeah.
You know, arts is going to – it's just something that's going to be a burden on government. It's going to cost us money. We've had a growing sort of anti-arts funding atmosphere in government going back at least to the Reagan administration. You know?
Yeah, and, you know, you can – and go back farther than that even. You know, you see these periodic cycles of pushback on funding for the arts. But I think part of the challenge is people just don't think about the arts as an industry. They think about it as this wonderful aspect, quality of life, worth, you know, investing in prosperous times, but hard to justify when the economy's struggling. When in fact, if you look at the data, just right here in the state of Hawaii, nonprofit arts, a $205 million industry. Mm-hmm. Spending by the organizations alone, $126 million. But the benefits don't stop there because, you know, when we go out to an arts and culture event, there's all kinds of event-related spending that goes with it. You know, you go, leave, you pay for parking. Yes, exactly. You have dinner. If you have little ones at home, you pay for babysitting. So we interviewed over 1,200 arts attendees as part of this study. We found out the typical attendee spends $25.26 per person per event, not including the cost of admission, every time they go to an arts event. If you're a local business, if you're a restaurateur or a retailer, if you have a parking garage, you know, you can see it. You know when there's a great exhibition happening or there's a fabulous performance happening. You know, it's putting cheeks in seats and derrieres and cafe chairs. It's good for business.
I like that phrase. That's got to be one you've used before.
It's a good one. Thank you.
Well, you know, you have that whole – so many of these things sound difficult to quantify, Randy.
Yeah, and
you've delved pretty deep compared to what's been done before,
right? And it's a very comprehensive economic study to change this and expand this conversation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we surveyed working with the Hawaii Arts Alliance, 268 of our nonprofit arts and culture organizations across the state here, across all the islands, and heard back from 109 of them. And that's the data that we go with. You know, we take a very conservative approach to this. Mm-hmm. And that's how we find out $126 million of spending. Arts organizations employ people locally, purchase goods and services in the community. They're members of the Chamber of Commerce. They help drive tourism. Arts organizations are good business citizens, and that's a myth buster for people.
Well, that's just what I was thinking of, Randy, because, you know, you don't have any trouble persuading me of this, for example. Mm-hmm. But when you take it to, say, a chamber of commerce, how does this pitch go over?
You know, it is so well received, I think our business leaders really appreciate the value of the arts to community and really see the arts as a core part of our communities. But when you can come in with some real quantifiable facts using rigorous methodologies and show that in addition to quality of life, in addition to Hawaii making Hawaii a great place to live and a great place to work, which helps you attract a skilled, educated workforce, it's also good for business. Mm-hmm. And when you have that conversation with our business leaders and our tourism leaders, it's almost like they have permission to talk about all the wonderful aspects of the arts and, you know, how the arts unify our communities and help us feel creative.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to wonder how that's going to go over, because you also wonder how we got to this place where we have this perception of arts as a sort of a frivolous segment of society, you know, people out there making mud pies and you know, not in the stream of commerce, getting and spending and making a living. Yeah. That it's, you know, the artist is someone who has chosen to detach and, you know, be up there in the studio doing whatever it is they do.
And what we've really seen with the research is that, you know, this economic research validates the role of the artists as part of the American workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not people sort of living in their garret, you know, painting by candlelight or something.
Exactly.
You know, in fact, it's part of a thriving economy. And the arts are infused in so many other places across our communities here in the state. You know, you see it on the streets. Obviously, it's a tourism draw. But in our schools, you know, the research is so powerful that when the arts are part of a young person's education, they're having better grade point averages, better standardized test scores, lower dropout rates. Even in our healthcare, you know, we were just hearing about that in an earlier segment, and it's all over the newspaper. When the arts are part of our healthcare, we have the research is clear: shorter hospital stays, fewer doctor visits, evidence that it saves money. The arts are so core to what we do and who we are as people. They're a fundamental component of our humanity. We are, however, to your point, in a society now where you have to find a way to quantify that, to really demonstrate for people that it's there, it's happening. And that's what's great about this research.
Well, that's exactly the question that comes to my mind, Randy, is this sinking in? Because, you know, for example, in the world of education, it is well documented that studying music and painting enhances your overall educational experience, and yet arts programs are dwindling in schools. I mean, it hasn't, you know, on the research level, you won't get many arguments, but on the implementation level, it's not happening.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a real challenge. It takes relentless messaging. That's why I'm here, you know, and talking to everybody, our business leaders, our arts leaders, our tourism leaders. But if you look at a national level, organizations like the Conference Board, that's the national organization for the Fortune 1000 companies in this country. Their research is so powerfully clear about the importance of creativity. Their business scholars studying business leaders have found creativity is among the top five applied skills that business leaders are looking for now. 72% of business leaders say hiring someone with creativity is of high importance. And they write in the conclusion of the report about how the two biggest indicators are of creativity are starting your own company and study the arts. So it's connecting the dots for a lot of people to something that, you know, probably once was intuitive, is no longer intuitive.
Yeah. Well, the sooner those dots get collected, the better for quite a few people, including yourself.
Right? Yeah, thanks. You know, and what it shows is that the arts aren't just nice. They're necessary.
Fair enough. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Randy Cohen is Vice President of Research and Policy at Americans for the Arts. He'll be the special guest for an art chat on Hawaii's creative economy tomorrow at 9 a.m. at the Hawaii State Art Museum in downtown Honolulu's Capital District.
Hi, I'm Liam Skilling from the William S. Richardson School of Law. You can hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Today in the Backyard Quiz, we looked back at the leprosy settlement on Molokai's Kalaupapa Peninsula. Now known as Hansen's disease, the disease arrived in Hawaii sometime around 1830 via the waves of immigrant laborers brought to work in Hawaii's sugarcane fields. Although we now have a cure for Hansen's disease, that was not the case in the 19th century, and it can lie dormant in the body for up to 20 years. By the 1840s and 50s, a noticeable number of cases were being identified. Worried public officials decided to act, and the Kingdom of Hawaii's legislature passed, quote, an act to prevent the spread of leprosy, which King Kamehameha V signed in 1865, within a year, the isolation colony at Kalaupapa had been opened. The 1865 law allowed for patients to be involuntarily relocated to the colony, and many victims of Maipake, or Chinese sickness, were sent to that remote town. It would later come to be known as Maihooka Awale, or the disease of exile and the disease that tears families apart. That's today's quiz. We didn't get a winner today, but if you've got a quiz for us, you can always send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Judas Iscariot was never put on trial. He had his own conscience to torment him. But what if he had? How would he have defended himself? What would his accusers have said about him? What were his motives for his betrayal? The play The Last Days of Judas Iscariot asks us to consider those questions and more. Mark Branner is the director of the upcoming Hawaii premiere, a Theater Found production coming to the Lab Theater at UH. Mark's also the producer of and an actor in the production, and he's with us in our studio. Hi, Mark. Thanks for coming
in. Thanks so much for having me.
You've had, obviously, a great many opportunities to immerse yourself in this production and consider the questions it raises. What are some of the questions that it raises?
Right. So in the Bible, in the biblical account, Judas is considered by many to be sort of the chieftain of sinners, the one who is the example for all of us, for the world, regardless of even nominal church belief. A Judas is a betrayer. Mm-hmm. So the ultimate question is there hope for Judas? Is there hope for his eternal salvation? And so the stakes on this play, thrillingly theatrical and comedic as it is, are really very high. Mm-hmm. Can Judas be saved? Is there grace for Judas?
Is it possible for us to commit crimes which are unforgivable?
Indeed. Is there an unforgivable sin? And if there is, what happens to those people? So really high stakes, really interesting questions asked throughout this production. So that's really the heart of this piece.
For so many people, you know, the idea of betrayal of trust, in so many ways, practically all crimes are in some sense betrayals of mm-hmm. trust.
Indeed.
And
right.
Kind of it's seen as an ultimate sin, you know.
Right.
Are all sins forgivable?
Indeed. And so what's so beautiful about this piece is that it allows, one, theatrically, so many people to come to the stand and testify for or against Judas. So we have his mother gets to testify for him, mm-hmm. A fictional character. But then historical characters, Sigmund Freud comes to the stand, Mother Teresa comes to the stand, people from the Bible, other disciples come to the stand. And then finally Satan comes to the stand to testify. And then the final scene is this beautiful moment between Jesus and Judas. I won't give too much away, but really asking compelling questions in a very dramatic and, again, very comedic piece in a way, interestingly.
What does Freud have to say about it?
Well, is there such a thing as a person who is not guilty for what they do because of their psychotic break or some psychotic problem that they have?
Well, you could try the insanity.
Exactly.
Defense.
So he was insane because sane people don't kill themselves.
Yeah.
And of course, he killed himself. So therefore, he was insane, and therefore, he's not guilty for his own actions.
Because that's a question that it's raised in a lot of criminal trials. Isn't all crime, isn't every murder an act of insanity?
Indeed. And so Freud has his say. Caiaphas, who often gets blamed, historically, oftentimes people laid the blame at Caiaphas's feet. And so it's the high priest of the Sanhedrin gets blamed, but he also gets his say. Everybody gets a differing opinion, which is it's a Rashomon-like quality to the play, that it's not a clear-cut winner to this case. It's obviously eternal life that we're talking about. It's a very metaphysically minded piece. And yet the thing that's so fun about it is that the playwright is really well known for his street idioms, mm-hmm. and his slang. And so the characters don't come off as preachy or religious, but they're us. They're fishermen and sailors of today's century.
In spite of the contemporary language and mm-hmm. the breaching of space and time with mm-hmm. characters from different centuries, is the play in some ways true to the biblical story?
It is. It is. So all of the accounts that we have heard from the different stories about hanging himself from a various tree and what Pilate did of washing his hands of the crime, all of that is brought to light. And so it is really quite factual. In fact, the original off-Broadway production, Sam Rockwell, well-known actor who's often in movies and that sort of thing, enlisted the help of a priest in New York to help him understand. And also the playwright enlisted the same priest to help him really craft this piece so that it would really delve into the history of this question, as well as trying to place that history in a contemporary scene.
It's a very fundamental questions of guilt and innocence,
right?
As well as how we treat, how we judge guilt,
right.
and innocence. Because
that is so true, and I think that's one of the things that's so compelling about the piece, is that we get to humanize Judas, somebody that so easy to demonize a person and put them, far away from us in some kind of purgatory. That's not me,
right?
But through
I
this
could
play,
never do that.
Right? I could never do that. You really get to see the humanity of Judas, and you get to see him and the relationship that he had with Jesus. He obviously followed Jesus as one of the disciples, had a very deep and intimate knowledge and love of Jesus, and so I think the humanizing and what theater does in bringing the empathy is to allow us to step into those shoes and say, wow, sometimes I've felt like I'm in despair, that I have no hope, that I'm beyond some forgiveness that I'm craving or some need of grace or love.
Because it would not be one's first impulse to identify with such a despicable character.
Exactly. Right? We've demonized him.
Yeah.
And so what the play does so beautifully is to allow him to come to life as a real person.
Does that give us some understanding of his motives?
I think the play wrestles with that. Why did he do what he did? And I think the play has some opinions about that. I don't think there's a clear-cut, this is why he did it. There's many witnesses that come with their opinions of why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, Judas said, I loved you, and I made a mistake, is his framing of it.
Really? Takes it on himself.
He says, I made a mistake.
Well, that's...
But I loved you. And so that is the crucial point of the piece, is that that love between Judas and Jesus, and what Jesus then does with somebody who has indeed committed the ultimate sin, betrayed him.
And his willingness to absorb the sins of the world.
Exactly, including the sin of Judas.
Plenty to mull over in this play.
A lot in this play, but really enjoyable to watch.
Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Branner, Associate Professor of Theater at the University of Hawaii Manoa, is the producer and director of the Theater Found production of The Last Days of Judas Iscariot by Stephen Adley Gergis, the 2015 Pulitzer Prize winner for drama. He also plays the part of Jesus. The production will run the weekends of August 18th and 25th and September 1st at UH Manoa's Earl Ernst Lab Theater.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Well, as always, there are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us at this point in our program every day for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today, there's a free event in Ward Village, actually, that will be tomorrow, highlighting Hawaiian music and hula.
That's right, Chris. It's called Kona Nights, Kona Nui Nights, and it's on the third Wednesday of every month. That would be tomorrow. The Osorio Ohana, featuring Duncan Kamakana of The Voice, also Jamaica, and Hoku Award winner John Osorio perform tomorrow night at 6 p.m. in the Ward Village Courtyard. Hula will be provided by Halau Na Puale o Likulehua. It's free, but you do need to RSVP at the link on our website.
Well, it's always good to hear about free events.
Mm-hmm.
And a museum in Pahoa is holding an art exhibit through October.
That's right. The Pahoa Village Museum is displaying the art of Julie Melko, who has been teaching art in the Puna District for over 30 years, and students there know her as the Art Lady. The museum is located in downtown Pahoa on Pahoa Village Road, and it's open every day except Sunday from 9 to 3.
I suspect the Art Lady has influenced quite a few
years. Art students, I'm sure. 30 years, yeah.
And there's a Hoku Award winner performing at Volcanoes National Park tomorrow night.
She is Kainani Kahonaile, and she will share songs from her two albums. Kainani is originally from Kauai and now lives in Hilo, teaching Hawaiian language at UH Hilo. Showtime tomorrow for this show is 6:30 p.m. It's in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium at Volcanoes National Park. It's free, but park entrance fees do apply for this concert.
It's always good to hear about so many things going on the neighbor islands, isn't it, Derek?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll talk with the Kohala Center about plans for new grant funds from NOAA. Plus, we'll hear the unique trio sound of Island Breeze. Comment about anything you hear on our program to our talkback line at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation, our Twitter at HI Conversation. If you miss part of the show or any other program we air, you can find them on the new HPR app. Just search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Chris Vandercook, and we'll meet up tomorrow for more of The Conversation.